And so today we take up the final message dealing with the first two commandments found in Exodus 20 verses 1 through 6, as you heard that I read and as we started last week as well. You notice the title of this sermon is A Persistent Stupidity. This is the assessment of the biblical writers and God's inerrant word regarding those who worship idols. And as we have been learning, that not only involves people who literally bow down to wooden and stone images, it involves a whole expansion of anything that can become God to us. And so in our last study about this commandment, I made the statement several times that there has been disagreement between Christians over the many centuries about the application of this part of God's law, because some have interpreted this as a strict rule prohibiting all painting, all sculpture, any artistic portrayal of anything, whether it directly relates to God or not, as in the person of Jesus, for example. But other Christians have taken a rather different interpretation, and so I want to explore that with you just a little bit this morning, because we're talking about the application of this to our lives. And let's think about that there is, first of all, a connection between art and religion. One of the things that becomes obvious when we study religion as a general topic of human society is that art, artistic expression, has historically been tied to it. Whether you're talking about primitive scratchings on caves to the most sophisticated sculptures of antiquity, the portraying of gods or demons or spirits, that's a strong impulse among human beings in all cultures. Now, in the days of the earliest followers of Jesus, there was a great deal of resistance and hostility to all painting and sculpture. Now, I mean the earliest days, say within the first 100 or 200 years or so. Because for those early Christians, art in any form was a direct link to the paganism from which they had turned away. It was not uncommon among them to require any artist or sculptor who had become a follower of Jesus to forswear the making of any images or in any form. Or they might be required to simply give up being an artist or sculptor altogether. But what about those who do worship with images? Whether they're worshiping the image or worshiping using the images. I'm bringing this up because within a few hundred years, churches in almost all parts of the Roman Empire began to explode with images and sculptures and mosaics and paintings, icons. An icon is a specialized form of Christian religious art that involves images of Jesus, the Virgin Mary, various saints, angels. All of these things began to be used in worship and to be venerated. So it went from the first 100 years or so, none of that, to within 200 to 300 to 400 years or so, just overwhelming amounts of it. At the same time, however, there were equally large numbers of Christians who opposed the use of images and icons. Now, I'm going to say something here, and I'll explain it more in a moment. It may sound like a contradiction, but in both those cases, those who worshipped with Christian images and those who opposed them were equally off base. Now, let me tell you why. And I'll use this story. It's about a man who was a missionary in the Far East. I don't know whether he saw this or he heard about it. About a 20-year-old man from whatever this country was. He went into a temple. He removed his sandals and he bowed down before an idol of the gods, of a god. And then he took out a dagger, a knife from his shirt pocket, and in one quick swipe, he cut off his tongue and he offered it to the silent, lifeless image of the god. Well, as you can imagine, within a few moments, the man collapsed, bleeding profusely, lying at the feet of this idol. Now, the question might be, why would someone do something like that? What would drive someone to such a drastic, suicidal action? Well, you know, there may be many answers to those kind of questions, but one of them is surely this. And this is the one that's often not well regarded or thought of. That man believed that the statue The image of that God was a true, realistic point of contact with that God or with the gods. He believed that either the statue itself was the God or that the statue was a real physical source of the presence of the gods. See, that type of thinking, that was the philosophy of life, the worldview of all the pagan cultures of antiquity, and especially those with which the Israelites would come in contact. So at the heart of this is the denying of any differences between the creator and the creature. We mentioned this last time. That's the belief that there's an internal link that exists between the supernatural powers of the gods and the world of human beings and things. So then in the ancient church, we find that many people who had come into it, they brought those kind of ideas with them. Now they knew they had to abandon some of it, but still the framework was there. Now, the Roman emperors, both before and after the empire had become Christianized, they were known to have images painted of themselves. And they would have these images sent to various parts of the empire so that people could worship in front of them, light candles to them. And I noticed I said this is before and after the Christianization of the Roman Empire. So the message in that was clear. The head of the Roman government and his image, these are the deputies of God on earth. This is where the intersection comes from. It was only natural then for some to fashion pictures of icons of Jesus and the saints. So this was already going on before Christ, and it continued, this making of images of the emperor after Jesus. Now look, these people did not believe that Christ himself actually became the icon or the statue. But they apparently believed that those objects became filled with supernatural power. So to paint an image of Jesus or the Virgin Mary was to create an object with a concentration of spiritual power or energy. Let me try to give you something of an analogy. Some of us here today grew up in an earlier time, or maybe perhaps have some familiarity with rural or farm life. And so many people in that category, we know what lightning rods are. Actually, our church steeple has a lightning rod. You can notice it when you leave today. It's not a very big one or prominent one, but it's there beside the steeple. But I recall as a boy when my sister and I would ride with my mother from Columbia to Abbeville County, where our kinfolks lived. You know, we would go on this two-hour drive, and one of the ways that my sister and I would pass the time would be to see how many farmhouses we could find that had lightning rods on their roofs. And if you've never seen one or don't know about it, these are metal rods that point straight up from the roof, and it's put there to be a point of contact between lightning during a thunderstorm and to channel that lightning down into the ground. The theory behind that is that having all of the energy of the lightning concentrated into that metal rod and then fed down into the ground through a cable wire. So now something like that kind of an idea is what motivated those in the early church, and for that matter, in many churches today even, who venerated and worshiped with images of Jesus. But as I said, there were those who opposed it. Now we might, just on hearing that, think that we are automatically in their category, and perhaps in some way we are, but not for the same reasons. There arose in the church in what we would call the 6th and 7th centuries, that's the 700 to 800s AD, the iconoclast controversy. That's the technical term for those who opposed the idea of worshiping without images. They were called iconoclasts, and that is a term that means one who smashes or destroys images. These people were fiercely opposed to the icon worshipers, but not for the reasons we would be, not for biblical reasons. You see, the iconoclast believed the same thing about the icons as the worshipers with icons did, but in their case, it led them to be vehemently opposed to icons specifically of Christ and the saints and the Virgin Mary. The problem for them was not so much that the Bible denounces idolatry. Their objection was that the emperor was the only one on earth worthy of that kind of depiction and praise and adulation by means of images. Now, there are different theories about this. I think this is the most correct about what motivated these iconoclasts. Between the governments of the church and the state, they believed that the government in the person of the emperor was as much of an incarnation of God's authority as was the church, perhaps even more so. That's why they saw the images of Christ as a competitive edge against the image of the emperor. So, in fact, these people were not very good allies, were they? In Isaiah 44, 9 to 10, we read this. Those who fashion a graven image are all of them futile, and their precious things are of no profit. Even their own witnesses fail to see or know, so that they will be put to shame. Who has fashioned a god or cast an idol to no profit? Look back again at verses 4 through 6 of Exodus 20. Listen carefully and notice what each verse says. Verse 4, you shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven or above, or what is on the earth, beneath, or in the water under the earth. Verse 5, you shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. So it reads in the New American Standard Bible. But now, in some translations of those verses, it's laid out a bit differently, because they are attempting to preserve the Hebrew grammar structure, the sentence structure. And I'm pointing this out because in that structure, we see that these three verses are, in fact, one long sentence. That's important because if we read verse 4 apart from verse 5, you might come to the conclusion that God means to prohibit all painting, all sculpture, and all, say, photography. And as I mentioned before, there have been Christians over the centuries who have interpreted those words in that way. But that kind of interpretation is, I believe at least, and there are many others who do, contrary to what Scripture teaches. You say, well, why would anybody think it's contrary? Because God himself, who upon giving the guidance for the construction of the temple at Jerusalem, required the making of images that were to adorn the inner sanctuary. So what the Lord is concerned to forbid here is the fashioning of idols or images for the express purpose of bowing down to them or worshiping God by means of them. So then, as I understand what the Bible teaches us here, there's nothing wrong with art per se. Anything that God has created is a fit subject of being portrayed artistically. And if you know anything about the history of our movement, in the Protestant Reformation, there was this massive flowering of amazing artwork from people like Rembrandt, as one example, the Dutchman, where prior to that in the Middle Ages and under the broad yoke of medieval Catholicism, the only kind of paintings that were done were otherworldly looking paintings, sort of like icons of Jesus and Mary and the saints. Nothing else was considered fit for portrayal. But because the Reformation gave us back a full-orbed biblical faith, people began to realize God created this world good. And because of Christ, we have been redeemed in him. So everything can be an expression of the greatness and the glory and the majesty and the grace of God. And that's why you find in Reformation-era art simple things like a bowl of apples, a woman looking out of a window, became a way of portraying all that is good in humanity because of us being created in God's image and God being the creator of all things. Yes, there is a distinction between the creator and the creation. But God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. There's nothing wrong with symbolism either. The Bible is a series of 66 books, many of which are filled with symbols and imagery. On the other hand, the Bible clearly forbids worshiping of icons and images and statues or symbols, or making use of them to somehow assist us in worship. But now let's focus now for the rest of this message. What are the results of worshiping with idols? What are some of the spinoffs of why we should not do this? Well, first of all, It creates a false relationship with a false God. It was the late J.I. Packer who noted that images dishonor God because they obscure his glory, because they are attempts to create something that reflects the Creator. And it bears witness to the fact that the false God that most people love to worship is the one that they can manage, the one that they can manipulate. And we see this in its most extreme form today with the so-called prosperity gospel. I mean, I've heard some of these teachers over the years and read some of their works. And, you know, they treat God like he's an ATM machine. Even one of them claimed that he was very near death. I don't know, I'll just say he was maybe 50 or 60 years old. And he said that he reminded God that in his word, God promised human beings a certain number of years. I'll say 70, so many score, 3 years or whatever it is. And he said, you can't let me die now because you promised to let people live this long. And so he claimed that he turned God's plan around by reminding God of this, as if God needs to be reminded of anything. Well, that's the kind of God that can be manipulated. But the Lord, in giving us these commandments, means to tell us that we are to worship the God who's big enough to manage us and manipulate us, if you will. And doing that, worshiping the true God and worshiping him properly, well, our eternity literally depends on it. In Isaiah 45, verse 20, reading from a somewhat paraphrased translation, "Gather together and come, you fugitives from surrounding nations. What fools they are who carry around their wooden idols and pray to gods that cannot save." Our attempts to make God more manageable, those attempts end up destroying us. Anything that becomes a God for us and to which we give our allegiance will eventually bring us to ruin. Now, most of you here today have on occasion heard me mention Oprah Winfrey. You'd think that I was her biggest fan. I'm not. But her cultural impact, especially in the 90s and the 2000s, is undeniable. I'm not sure if you may remember, but when her daily TV show was still on and her magazine was a big seller, she was quite often in the news, for one particular reason at least, because of her running battle with obesity. And according to Ms. Winfrey, she continually battled with gaining up to 237 pounds, dieting, losing weight, and then gaining it all back until she found a very special personal trainer. And that man, whose name was Bob Green, helped her develop a very intense, specialized 10-step program that included exercise routines and, of course, a diet. And it really did the trick for Oprah Winfrey. But she told an interviewer that Green's 10-step program was not the most important thing that she learned from him. She said that what really turned the tide in her battle with weight gain was his helping her understand why she wanted to eat all the time and eat so much. And in this People magazine interview, she said, now this is a quote, she said that food had become a god for her. It became her source of love and comfort and pleasure and friendship. Now I tell you that because I think that's a pretty good example of our modern day types of idol worship. Substituting something that God has made, food for example, for the God who made it. And people who do that are making an understandable attempt to address a real need in their lives. I mean, it's the need for transcendence, the need for a true spirituality. That's the way God made all of us. That's what it means to be created in his image, or one of the things. But he also has made us to be in a relationship with him exclusively, and to substitute anything in his place, be it food or money or success, all of it is a dead end. Another result, of worshiping idolatrously is that it creates a lack of individual responsibility. And that may not be readily apparent, but listen, we live in a culture where individual responsibility is a vanishing trait. And we act as if our hang-ups, for example, they are our gods when we ascribe power to those shortcomings and shortfalls. Maybe you've heard these kind of excuses. Well, my behavior wasn't my fault. It's this disability I have. It's this addiction I have. And of course, as I share this with you, we all know the big one now is I'm a victim of racism. Some people rob, rape, murder, kill, steal, and they blame it on, say, post-traumatic stress syndrome or a lack of self-esteem or because they're victims of racism. And there are scientists who have been diligently searching for the genes that lead to alcoholism, they think, and homosexuality. On that note, I remember seeing or hearing an interview with the comedian Chevy Chase. You know, he used to be a big movie star and was on Saturday Night Live. And apparently he struggled with addiction. I don't remember if it was alcohol, I think it was, or some other substance. But I'll never forget, he said he had checked himself into one of these places that the movie stars go to dry out or whatever it is. And I think he said after a period of time, he removed himself from it because he said, all they basically were doing is telling me I wasn't really responsible for my own condition. And he got out of there and finally found a way or found someone who helped him take responsibility for what he was doing to himself, and he overcame. See, if we use that kind of an excuse for deviant or destructive behavior, that's exactly what we're saying. These things are gods to us. The idolatrous power we ascribe to our circumstances or our genetics are merely an attempt to relieve us of the guilt of violating God's law. It makes him more manageable. That line of reasoning might work on this side of eternity for humanists. But when we all stand before God on the dread judgment day, it won't be accepted. The true God calls us to individual responsibility, not lame excuses. But then thirdly, another result of idol worship, or worshiping idolatrously, is that it adversely affects our lives and that of others. That's what's being gotten at here in this verses 5 and 6. Let me read it again from a paraphrase. I do not leave unpunished the sins of those who hate me, but I punish the children for the sins of their parents to the third and fourth generations. But I lavish my love on those who love me and obey my commandments even for 1,000 generations. Now we need to stop here and remind ourselves of something that I mentioned last week. People have the idea in reading this, and it's even more evident, perhaps mistranslated. It's a hard thing to translate these words exactly. But the idea is that God makes someone else, in this case the children, to pay for the wrongdoings of the parents. That, however, is not what the commandment is actually teaching. It doesn't say that God punishes one person for what another person has done. No, because God is just. He is righteous. He punishes people for their own sins, not those of someone else. He declares so, for example, in another part of the law in Deuteronomy 24:16. He says, fathers shall not be put to death because of their children, nor shall children be put to death because of their fathers. Each one shall be put to death for his own sin. And then in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 18, verse 20, the son will not bear the punishment of the father's iniquity, nor the father bear the punishment for the son's iniquity. The righteousness of the righteous will be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked will be upon himself. So the point of this portion of the commandment is that God will punish the children for the sins of their parents if they commit the same sins as the parents. God is saying that if you engage in idolatry in any of its variegated forms, your children and grandchildren probably will too. And unless you get this right, they're going to repeat your mistakes and suffer the same devastating effects. They will attempt to follow your pattern of managing God. Why will they do that? Because in God's plan and purpose, for better or worse, children learn about God from their parents. The family is the first church, state, and government. That's the first government children are exposed to. That's the first church children are exposed to. What goes on in the family? So parents etch the image of God on the hearts of their children, in a manner of speaking. I think I may be speaking for all of us here and saying that until this past year, and even continuing today, most of us at some point enjoyed watching sports on television, whether it be college football or Major League Baseball or NFL or whatever it may be. Would you ever suspect, if you're a big sports fan, that something like football or baseball could become an idol that we worship? Maybe you could. And there have been different examples that have been given of that. Would it occur to us that this is a form of idolatry that we might unknowingly pass on to our children? Back in 1996, the Green Bay Packers won the Super Bowl that year was held in New Orleans. And their famous quarterback, Brett Favre, was named the NFL's most valuable player. However, during a home game in Green Bay, Wisconsin, prior to the Super Bowl, some fans at the Lambeau Field, at that home game prior to the Super Bowl, they folded a large banner up in the stands, and on that banner were etched these words. Listen carefully. Our Favre, who art in Lambeau, hallowed be thy arm. The bowl will come, it will be won in New Orleans as it is in Lambeau. Give us this Sunday our weekly win and give us many touchdown passes. But do not let others pass against us. Lead us not into frustration, but deliver us to Bourbon Street. For thine is the MVP, the best of the NFL, and the glory of the cheeseheads now and forever. Go get them. Let me ask you, what if you had been at that home game prior to the Super Bowl, where that banner was unfurled with your sons and daughters with you? What might be your reaction if you saw it? Would you just laugh it off? No big deal? Ha ha. If our God is an idol, guess who's going to carry around that same idea of God? Our children. Another thing is that worshiping wrongly, worshiping in an idolatrous fashion, stunts our growth. See, in the final analysis, idols reflect who and what we are. We prefer to project our nature onto God rather than have Him restore His Spirit in us. You see, if our God is not truly God, the true God, we will never rise above ourselves. If we examine our lives, we see that we're not, say, becoming any more godly. It may be because we're worshiping an idol instead of the true God. If we still cave in to the same sins that have plagued us for years, maybe our God is the wrong God. If people would not automatically describe us as someone growing in Christ's likeness, maybe He's not the God we're following. Maybe we're following the user-friendly, seeker-sensitive God who merely reflects the selfish images of our modern culture. Friends, growing up into maturity, becoming more and more faithful in our devotion to following Jesus, those things only happen as we bow the knee and come face to face with the absolute true God who has declared in His Word in the book of Psalms, shame on all who serve images, who pride themselves on their idols. Bow down to Him, all you gods, for you are Yahweh, most high over all the earth, far transcending all gods. Yahweh loves those who hate evil. He keeps safe His faithful. He rescues them from the clutches of the wicked. Amen. Let us pray.